Chapter 18. Cope. Sleep, mindfulness, exercise. Life is going to throw you fastballs, curveballs, screwballs, and every so often, you're even going to get hit by the pitch. Despite your best efforts, your candidate loses, your kid gets sick, and you don't get hired for that ideal job. So how do you cope without being a curmudgeon or throwing in the towel? Oh, I know you've heard it all before. Eat right, exercise, get enough sleep, and breathe. First, what do any of those things mean? How much is the right amount? Second, it's not just about reducing your eye puffiness or fitting into those Lululemon leggings. There's hard science behind this. One of the primary drivers of reward and inhibitors of contentment is stress. Yet, it's not the specific stressor that matters. It's the individual's response to stress and how long it goes on that determines whether that particular stress is adaptive or maladaptive. For instance, most people would view studying for a test or running the 100-meter dash in the Olympics as good stress, in part because the stress is acute, there are positive benefits to be had, and you can see yourself being happy past the end of the event. Conversely, most people would view high demands at work or caring for a parent with dementia as bad stress, in part because the stress is chronic, there are few, if any, benefits to be had, and there's no expectation of being happy, no light at the end of the tunnel. But chronic stress doesn't just wreak havoc on the individual. It costs everyone. A recent report from Harvard and Stanford Business Schools puts the annual price tag of U.S. work stress at 120,000 lives and $190 billion. Jazz vocalist Bobby McFerrin beseeched us, "Don't worry, be happy." Great idea, but what drives worry and how do you reverse it? Throwing Jiminy a life preserver. Tamping down anxiety is the function of the prefrontal cortex, your own internal Jiminy Cricket, yet it also tamps down the experience of reward. When it's working properly, the prefrontal cortex will reduce amygdala output, the fear center, I don't need to fear this, and increase hippocampus function, that's the memory center, I've been here before. Focus you, keep you to the task at hand, and reduce hypothalamic activation to maintain low cortisol levels, which keeps your metabolic functions stable. But when the prefrontal cortex is worn out or damaged from years of chronic stress, as can happen in communities where the population is food insecure, like not knowing where the next meal is coming from, Memphis or Sudan, or life insecure, fear of being in the crossfire, like Chicago or Istanbul, then cognitive control is disinhibited and impulsivity is let loose. A dysfunctional prefrontal cortex means less restraint on that reward pathway, with the prospect for non-stop reward seeking for ever elusive pleasure and ultimately an increased risk for addiction. And that's not all. A crippled Jiminy also means an increase in cortisol, a suppression of serotonin 1A receptors, and an increased risk for depression. Nurturing our PFC should be our prime directive. Unfortunately, our environment has claimed our PFC as collateral damage. We have three simple methods to give our PFC the rest it needs: sleep, mindfulness, and exercise. But unfortunately, none of these are simple in modern society, although each is crucial to your physical and mental well-being. Let's deal with each in turn. Sleeping your way to the top. As we showed in chapters 9 and 10, sleep is essential to optimizing serotonin and mood. The brain, after a good night's sleep, processes information differently than a sleep-deprived brain, with decreased activity in the amygdala and increased connectivity to the PFC. Consistently getting a good night's sleep corresponds with beneficial changes in the brain, including your memory centers and your Jiminy. Conversely, chronic sleep deprivation results in increased dopamine and reduced serotonin, while the increased psychological stress and cortisol of sleep deprivation will decrease the serotonin 1A receptors. Stress impedes the duration and quality of sleep, which leads to more stress. And around we go. Sleep deprivation takes its toll on your brain's capacity to function. In one 5-day study, adults were randomly selected to be in one of four groups: normal workload plus 8 hours of sleep, normal workload plus 5 hours of sleep, excessive workload plus 8 hours of sleep, and finally excessive workload plus 5 hours of sleep. As you might expect, increased workload led to fatigue and sleepiness regardless of sleep duration, but did not alter quantitative work performance or wakefulness tests. Sleep restriction on its own led to a worsening of all cognitive tests. Perhaps not surprisingly, with increased work demands and less sleep, subjects performed markedly worse on all tests, and with actual changes in brain activity, along with adverse brain metabolic changes, especially in the prefrontal cortex. Sleep deprivation also takes its toll on the immune system. If you give a group of healthy adults a cold virus and isolate them for 5 days, which factors influence whether or not they're going to get sick? Sleep. Those who slept less were 5 times more likely to develop colds. Could increasing sleep duration turn this around? At the present, 35% of Americans get less than 7 hours of sleep per night. Optimally, you should get 8. And clinical insomnia, can't fall or stay asleep, befalls 23% of the adult population. Using 8 hours as our benchmark, adults maintain a sleep debt of 60 to 90 minutes per night, which is not recompensed by sleeping in on the weekends. In fact, your brain has an internal clock, and it doesn't like to be unwound. It prefers that you go to bed and wake up at the same time every day. Work environments generally value those who come in early and stay late, and those who respond to emails at 11 p.m. And yet, this can actually worsen an employee's job performance and overall well-being. In fact, sleep deprivation causes an average of 7.8 days per year of lost work performance and costs employers about $2,280 per capita, or a total of $83 billion per year in the United States. Outside the U.S., employers and governments have picked up on this statistic. Most recently, France passed a law that prohibits employees from checking their work emails after 5 p.m. and on weekends. In contrast, many Americans are perpetually glued to their email during dinner, in traffic, and even while picking up their kids from daycare. One enterprising Texas daycare put a sign up on their door: "Get off your phone! Your children are glad to see you! Are you happy to see your child?" Most people, when faced with the adverse consequences of their sleep debt, would opt for a quick nap. But unfortunately, while naps acutely improve cognitive functioning, they do not repair the negative mood of chronic sleep deprivation. And most people don't take naps. They drink coffee or take 5-hour energy drinks. The caffeine will worsen their chances for restful sleep, and they get the added bonus of kicking their dopamine reward system into overdrive. Let's see you climb down now. Not sleeping will seriously harsh your mellow, thereby skewing your serotonin and any possibility of your achieving zen. A good night's sleep is not a luxury. It's a necessity. The sounds of sleep. One of the most significant causes of sleep debt is known as obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA. If you're one of the 35% of Americans with sleep debt, you might well be suffering from it. In OSA, the airway collapses while asleep, preventing oxygenation and carbon dioxide exchange. At its extreme, OSA can irreversibly damage the right side of your heart, It can even kill you, albeit slowly and over years. People normally associate OSA with obesity, and for good reason. The fat around the neck contributes to the collapsing of the airway, and OSA stimulates the hunger hormone ghrelin, causing increased appetite. So OSA and obesity form a vicious cycle of weight gain and metabolic dysfunction, with resultant overeating and depressed mood. But that's just scratching the surface. Lots of normal weight people also get OSA, possibly due to reduced muscle tone in the neck closing off the airway, and are at just as much risk for metabolic problems. The best way to figure out if you have OSA is to ask your bed partner if you snore. I promise, they won't lie. The next best way is to record yourself when you sleep. And one final way is to notice if you wake up with a headache not related to how many cocktails you consumed the night before. If you have OSA, what are your options, and will they work? The standard mode of medical therapy is continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP, a machine that blows air into the airway with a form-fitting face mask. In one study of 300 women who suffered from sleep apnea, treatment with a CPAP machine not only helped them to sleep, but they also reported a better quality of life, improved moods, better prefrontal cortex function, and decreased levels of anxiety and depression. In insomniacs, people who have a hard time falling asleep and staying asleep, cognitive behavioral therapy can also improve clinical depression. But CPAP is uncomfortable and noisy, which actually makes getting to sleep harder until people get used to it. Nonetheless, these studies show that when your sleep improves, your mood also improves, and your serotonin is moving in the right direction. What about the rest of us who can't seem to shake the impending doom of tomorrow? Practicing good sleep hygiene can help. Unplugging all electronics in your bedroom is one of the best things you can do for sleep quality. Tossing and turning? The remote is your enemy. No binge-watching Netflix in your bedroom. No TV in there at all. Blackout curtains can help. Understandably, you may not be able to unplug all the electronics in your bedroom, like your alarm clock. There are lots of things you can do to try to improve sleep hygiene. Keeping your bedroom cool and dark with plenty of fresh air, taking a warm bath or shower before bed, not eating or drinking after dinner, making sure to urinate before getting into bed, and, most importantly, no screen time for 1 hour before bedtime. This last one might be the most difficult for us to get used to. Many Americans deal with insomnia or try to wind down by binging on Netflix after checking their work email or Snapchat or Facebook. But the blue light emanating from the screen keeps your melatonin, the hormone in your brain that tells you that it's dark outside, from rising, causing a phase shift in your sleep cycle and guaranteeing that you'll feel awful in the morning. Try picking up a book instead. The myth of multitasking. What would happen if we did get enough sleep? Would our stress be lifted? Would our PFCs be any happier, and would we? Apart from sleep, the studies I've mentioned previously suggest that there's an additive effect of workload and psychological stress on subjective well-being. Other studies certainly bear this out, as they point to reductions in PFC function and increase in cortisol levels. No doubt, these effects on the PFC make for diminished executive function, that is, decision-making, and increased amygdala activation of more cortisol, driving long-term metabolic dysfunction like diabetes and immune system defects like inflammation. A lot of stress comes from our screens, and not just the blue light that gives us insomnia. Full-blown internet addiction is particularly worrisome and even life-threatening. Yet many people suffer from a less severe but related problem commonly known as multitasking, that is, simultaneously processing multiple incoming streams of information, like reading live tweets while IMing your sister as you watch the latest episode of Game of Thrones. While multitasking existed before the advent of the internet and mobile devices, the combination of these two technologies has shot this practice through the roof. Overall media use among America's youth has increased 20% over the past decade, yet the amount of time spent multitasking with media increased by over 119% over the same period. Adults who engage in multitasking find themselves increasingly stressed. Many think that multitaskers are gifted people who are to be envied, as they are able to perform several tasks at once without compromising quality of effort or work performance. They are the pride of most companies, as they seem to juggle all the balls, keep the paper moving, take no vacations, and keep coming back for more. The overachievers that make you look like a slacker and force you to measure up. I guess that's true for the entire 2.5% of the population that can do this well. Those imbued with this innate talent keep their PFCs whirring along despite dissonant information being pelted at them. Yet multitasking, like sleep deprivation, which often go hand in hand, eventually takes its toll on the rest of us. In one cross-sectional study, heavy media multitaskers were more susceptible to interference from irrelevant stimuli, were less able to screen out irrelevant information, and performed worse on tests of task-switching ability. And multitasking alters blood flow in the PFC, as well as other information processing areas associated with executive function. Yep, if you spend too much time creating and retorting with memes, your Jiminy can get hindered. These results argue that multitasking is associated with deficits in fundamental information processing. In other words, overachieving is accomplished with the help of smoke and mirrors, which may turn out to be a major contributor to our depressed mood all by itself. Multitasking, by increasing psychological stress, is associated with clinical depression and might actually increase degenerative changes in the brain. But again, this is correlation, not causation. If you're a mere mortal, does multitasking cause changes in PFC function? And if so, are they reversible? Or are people with PFC dysfunction more likely not to sleep and multitask instead, say, starting a tweet storm at 3:20 a.m.? We're still not sure. Nonetheless, cutting down on multitasking to improve brain function and mood has been catching on. The easiest strategy is, turn off your phone, all caps, idiot! Why do you think France banned work emails after hours? Try it. Try to live without your cell phone for 5 days. The angst that knowing the phone is there, but you can't turn it on or email, the tremor of your hand, the sweat on your brow, the feeling as though a limb had been removed, is more than enough to demonstrate phenomena of both tolerance and dependence, consistent with addiction. Professional blogger Andrew Sullivan beautifully described his descent into cyber Hades in his article, I Used to Be a Human Being, in New York Magazine. In the process of rehabilitation, he rediscovered his sense of self. Of course, the problem with doing this is that some of us actually do need to be connected in order to perform our jobs, pay the bills, and keep track of our family members. Worse yet, voice command recognition technology, such as Siri or Alexa, has eliminated vast numbers of service jobs around the world and will continue to do so, which means that you can't disconnect even when you want to. Nonetheless, taking the time to unplug, even for only an hour a day, is one of the most rewarding things that you can do, as it's the path to reduce both dopamine and stress, improve sleep, and hopefully allow your serotonin to do its job. Don't just do something, stand there. Another bona fide method to engage your PFC in a meaningful way and give your emotional brain, or the amygdala, a rest is meditation, which is becoming more and more popular everywhere, from the classroom to the boardroom. Meditation has been around for millennia, and it's practiced in many cultures and religions. For instance, Buddhist meditation practice, where you rid your mind of extraneous thoughts, a ritual closely aligned with attainment of spiritual happiness, has been shown to prospectively increase PFC activity, healing your Jiminy. The most recent spin is a non-denominational practice called mindfulness, and we know more about its effects because we've been able to actually examine the brain before and after mindfulness practice within an MRI scanner. Based on Buddhist tradition, this technique was adapted by Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn to help patients deal with chronic pain and has since become a mainstream method for reducing the effects of stress on the body and the brain. The basic premise is to live in the moment. By learning to observe your thoughts and emotions, dealing with the past and future without acting on them. By focusing strictly on the present, recognizing that no one is in control of either the past or the future, you act like a scientist and observe the natural phenomena within your own mind, leaving you in a state of greater peacefulness. A favorite exercise is to eat one raisin. Very, very slowly, over about 10 minutes. You roll it around on your tongue, explore the rough surface, bite into it in slow motion, and all of a sudden, it isn't a raisin. By doing so, stress and distractibility diminish. It's a new experience that you've never had before. At least, that's the concept. Ostensibly an enjoyable one, although not everyone agrees. See the Meditation for Real Life series in the New York Times. Mindfulness sounds very new age, kind of like a brain colonic, but there's a lot of neuroscience that goes with it, including research showing that meditators have clear differences in brain structure. A meta-analysis of studies comparing meditators and non-meditators demonstrates changes in the brain related to the size of the frontopolar cortex and insula, which governs body awareness, the hippocampus, which governs memory, the corpus callosum, transmission between the two halves of the brain, and perhaps most importantly, the anterior cingulate cortex and the prefrontal cortex, that Jiminy Cricket, those areas involved in executive function that keep you from doing stupid things. Of course, we are still left with the cause and effect question. Does meditation help your PFC, or do people with better PFCs choose to meditate, or both? We just don't have long-term longitudinal data as of yet. However, one study in veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as traumatic brain injury, did find beneficial effects of mindfulness-based training that lasted 3 months post-training, and mindfulness-based training increases neural connectivity in regions known to play a role in empathy. So you feel better and are generally a nicer person. Win-win. Like any skill, it takes daily practice to master mindfulness. Those who practice it swear by it, but it's definitely not something you just dabble in. I'm a pretty anxious guy myself, so 8 years ago, I took the mindfulness-based stress reduction course at the UCSF Osher Center for Integrative Medicine here in San Francisco. I've personally found the experience quite valuable, even though I don't practice it every day like I should. I learned that anxiety is excitement about the future. The problem is that the future never comes, and it's almost always worse in my head than it is in reality. Today, I would worry about what might happen tomorrow, then tomorrow would come, and I would be focused on the day after that, and so on. So you're never really in control. This is a great way to make yourself miserable. By focusing and spinning out on what might or might not happen tomorrow, and what I had done yesterday, I was missing out on the fun and enjoyment of what was happening today. By always focusing on the future and the past, I generated my own chronic stress, and I was always missing out on the happiness of today. This realization was a revelation, a light bulb going off in my brain, and it's part of the reason why I wrote this book. Whenever my thoughts take me to tomorrow or yesterday, or what the future may or may not hold, which always leads to anxiety. I instead refocus my attention on what is good, and of course bad, that's happening today. And my self-assessment is that today, right now, is usually pretty darn good. I find that I am much calmer, I fidget less, and I am much less distractible. I also stopped eating when I'm not hungry, as I'm not eating for stress anymore. I revel in today. And tomorrow? Well, tomorrow will be here soon enough and will take care of itself. I downloaded a stress reduction app on my iPhone. I have found the best time to use it is when I'm on a plane, after pulling away from the gate and waiting in line for takeoff. I used to feel angst about the wait. Not any longer. Try it. Right now. Close your eyes. Feel the sensations around you. What do you hear? What do you sense? Do you feel your feet pressing into the floor? Your hands on this book or computer? What do you smell? Focus on right now. Not what do I need to do tomorrow? What will I have for dinner? What will we do this weekend? Try this for 5 minutes. And focus on a saying. It can be any saying, like, I am here. I have enough. I am content. I am safe. I'll wait. For these 5 minutes, everything other than your breath is a distraction. Can't think of a good mantra? Be thankful for 5 minutes. Make a gratitude list of things and people you're thankful for. Harder than you thought, isn't it? Try for 5 minutes a day for 30 days and see if and how it changes you. Mind over matter. My UCSF reward eating team has studied the effect of a 12-month mindfulness intervention added on to a standard diet exercise program for obese patients along with a 6-month follow-up period. Half received just the diet and exercise intervention, while the other half received mindfulness training and the instructions to practice every day for about 40 minutes. We were mildly surprised that the mindfulness subjects lost only a small and not significant amount of additional weight compared to the control subjects. But the more they practiced mindfulness, the fewer sweets they ate, and the better their blood glucose control, suggestive of improved metabolic health. However, when we looked at specific fat depots in the body, we were encouraged to find that the mindfulness group had lost a lot of visceral or big belly fat, while their subcutaneous or big butt fat remained essentially the same. Visceral fat is not like any other fat in your body, while subcutaneous fat accounts for anywhere from 5 to 45% of your body weight. Visceral fat only encompasses 4 to 6%. So when you stand on a scale, which are you measuring? You don't know. Subcutaneous fat, for the most part, is not metabolically active, and once formed is extremely difficult to eradicate. But excesses of subcutaneous fat do not contribute to poor metabolic health, other than the fact that the people who don't like their bodies experience psychological stress because of it. In fact, subcutaneous or big butt fat can actually be protective in some cases. Conversely, it's the visceral fat that's the driver of the diseases of metabolic syndrome and depression. This relationship has now been well documented in adolescents and adults. In our UCSF adult mindfulness study, virtually all subjects improved their metabolic health significantly. Fasting insulin, glucose, triglycerides, all reduced over the 12 months and stayed reduced even after the intervention was over. These data suggested that mindfulness meditation reduced visceral fat, which in turn improved various health parameters. Now, while no prospective study has yet been done, it's likely that mindfulness would prevent these metabolic problems from occurring in the first place. How do we know your propensity to accumulate visceral fat is not just genetic? Well, to factor out other influences, you would have to look at identical twins. A recent study from Finland took 10 sets of identical twin adult males who had the same weight and BMI as their twin, the same eating patterns, the same living conditions, etc. The only thing they differed on was leisure time physical activity. One twin was active, the other a couch potato. The researchers evaluated all their metabolic parameters, all their calories consumed, and finally, all of their fat depots. In each case, the inactive twin carried about 4 extra pounds of visceral fat, probably the reason that the inactive twin weighed 4 pounds more than the active twin. And it was this visceral fat that correlated with their cardiovascular fitness and their fasting glucose and insulin levels. This study shows us clearly that inactivity is associated with increased visceral fat. Exclusive of energy intake or genetics or family background or upbringing. And it's the visceral fat that predicts future metabolic disease. Visceral fat is the most malleable fat depot in the body. It's the easiest to lose. And it's the visceral fat that is directly amenable to exercise. Exercise sculpts your brain as well as your body. Doctors have known for decades that exercise is the single best thing you can do for yourself, both physically and mentally. Everyone thinks exercise makes you lose weight, yet there is not one study anywhere in the world's literature that shows that exercise alone causes weight loss. It causes visceral fat loss, but it also causes muscle gain. So the two tend to cancel out, and sometimes body weight even goes up. The question is, can exercise treat major depressive disorder? Another question, can it make non-depressed people happier? Many people have heard of the endorphin rise with significant exercise, or runner's high. Does it open the gateway to happiness as well? Many prospective trials have now been conducted, and the overwhelming majority demonstrate that exercising is better than not exercising. Exercise is about as good as SSRIs in treating depression, and exercise plus SSRIs is better than SSRIs alone. And it doesn't matter what kind of exercise. Cardio and resistance training both work. One explanation for these findings is that we know that stress increases cortisol, and that cortisol corresponds with decreased cell birth in the hippocampus. We aren't exactly sure how or why, but greater numbers of cells in the hippocampus is associated with happiness. Fewer cells equals more chance for depression. Exercise both increases the birth of these cells and offsets stress-induced cell death. One of the reasons we think antidepressants work is because they also correspond with new cells being born in the hippocampus. If we somehow negate or squash the growth of these cells, antidepressants don't work at all. Perhaps the most fabled benefit of exercise is the aforementioned runner's high, the sudden onset of euphoria experienced by hardcore marathoners. This phenomenon has been attributed to the release of the endogenous opioid peptide beta-endorphin. And more recently, we've learned that the added benefit of sedation and alleviation of anxiety is due to the simultaneous release of endocannabinoids, our own personal hash stash present throughout the brain, yet without giving us the munchies. Well, that's great if you're a marathoner, but does exercise work in mere mortals who may be unhappy, but not necessarily clinically depressed? Here the data are harder to come by. In large analyses with many subjects, there appears to be a significant effect of exercise on improved mood. Even adolescents who are by nature moody can benefit from exercise's effects on mood and depression. Of course, with some kids being perpetually glued to their smartphones or World of Warcraft, they're getting less exercise now than in years past. And in a meta-analysis of 1,500 elderly people, exercise was found to be effective in decreasing symptoms of depression. But these are research studies, and people don't live in a vacuum. Weather, temperature, wind, and elevation all impact on one's desire and performance of exercise. A group in China took this on by geocoding, that is, using geographic variables, to compare levels of happiness in 28 countries around the world. They also adjusted for GDP. Their findings showed that, after having adjusted for all the confounders, physical activity correlated with well-being, and lack of physical activity with the greatest unhappiness. The effects of both meditation and exercise are real, but likely not enough to turn depression into joy. What about combining the two? Might there be additive effects? One short-term study paired both together. First, subjects engaged in a 40-minute mindfulness practice, and then they got on a treadmill for another 40 minutes for 8 weeks. The results showed that the combination of the two was better at alleviating depression than was either one alone. We shouldn't be surprised that virtually any stimulus that increases psychological stress also inhibits PFC functioning and can ultimately foster addiction. And any stimulus that specifically increases visceral fat will increase the risk for depression. Conversely, anything that can attenuate either of these two phenomena can turn these negative emotions around. All of these remedies are tried, tested, and guaranteed, or your money back. But hey, since none of them cost any money, don't expect a refund. There's an app for that. Or is there? But here's where the technology industry will try to get its hooks into you. Many companies and digital app manufacturers have been proffering personalized health monitoring and programs in the name of wellness. What is wellness, anyway? Most insurance companies define wellness as absence of illness, because for them, it's about not paying benefits. If they don't hear from you, you must be well. Exercise trainers equate physical fitness with wellness. But what if you're physically fit but financially destitute? Or what if you're sleep-deprived? Meditation coaches define wellness as a state of spiritual calm or lack of stress. But what if you're calm because you smoke a few joints or take a few drinks to make the world go away? Each person has his or her own definition of wellness. But wellness really means so much more, and contentment is at the top of the list. These companies will sell you a wearable computer that will do everything from monitoring your step count to monitoring your blood pressure to monitoring your blood glucose. They'll sell you a set of ready meals brought to your door and buzz you when it's time to exercise and sleep and determine for how long you engaged in both. And some people are changing their behavior because of them. There are more than 40,000 smartphone apps on the market devoted to health and fitness. They have digital apps that can monitor your emotional well-being and use techniques such as self-monitoring, providing feedback on performance, and goal setting. Some of these apps are gamified with badges and monetary rewards to increase compliance. They'll monitor your mindfulness and provide reminders to walk. You can compete with your friends to get steps in. We're like Pavlovian dogs, trained to respond to the dings on our cell phones. Clearly, a burgeoning cottage industry. All of this sounds too good to be true. Because it is. Oh, yeah, there are companies and apps that will monitor your every heartbeat and generate lots of data. But do they alter your health or well-being? A systematic review of 27 randomized controlled trials of smartphone apps yielded modest evidence of efficacy, with only half showing benefits. Those that improved health tended to do so in conjunction with other modalities, such as a trainer or coach. These studies were not very long, ranged in duration from 1 to 24 weeks, with a mean of 10 weeks. Only half the studies monitored continued engagement with the smartphone app, and we know that app usage usually falls off at the 4 to 6 week mark, because these apps have yet to learn how to turn data into information that the individual can use. And the lack of actionable data leads most users to eventually curtail their use over time. These algorithms are just not ready for prime time. Back to the prime suspect. Stress and sedentary behavior have been around for a while. Yet today, addiction and depression are overwhelming public health problems. Now, at long last, we must deal with the most pernicious denizen of our Western environment and culture, the most toxic stress of all, the factor that causes more cases of addiction, depression, disease, and unhappiness than all the others combined. The toxic brew to which all of America, and indeed the entire world, old and young, rich and poor, Caucasian and African American and Latino and Asian, educated and not, is now exposed. The toxic constituent that masquerades as our pal, our homie, our BFF. The toxic item that has invaded our homes, our schools, our workplaces, and our bodies, and we willingly open the door. Toxic food.